Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 5th of January. Medicare is on the table the first hour of our program today, with more than 1.5 million baby boomers a year signing up for this program. Its future is one of the most important economic issues for anybody who's 50 or older, and 50 or younger for that matter. Healthcare costs are the most unpredictable part of retirement. Medicare is really a very good deal. And when you talk about changing Medicare, a lot of people get upset because many people like this program. This hour, we are going to talk about the future of Medicare. And a lot of people are saying, no matter what your political persuasion, that the future of Medicare is going to be different than what we have now. Medicare, as we know it, is not a part of the future of the program. So what might it be? Where are the problem areas? How could it be tweaked, or does it need to be changed in order for seniors to be able to have good health care? Our guest this hour is Professor Stuart Altman. He's professor of national health policy at Brandeis University, serves as chair of the Health Industry Forum and the chair of the Council on the Economic Impact of Health System Change. He's an economist. His research interests are primarily in the area of federal and state health policy. He is the author of Power, Politics, and Universal Healthcare, the inside story of a century-long battle. I anticipate we're going to have many phone calls on this issue, so feel free to call us as early as you would like. We'll take phone calls early on in the show. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Stuart Altman, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
We'll have a rip-roaring good conversation, I'm sure. Tell me why this program, you talk about changing it, and all of a sudden you're not talking as much about changing it, because people tend to love Medicare. Am I right?
Absolutely. Medicare is probably, along with Social Security, the most successful federal program that I know of, and gets a lot of kudos on both sides of the aisle. So changing it, and what is a concern to many, reducing it, runs into strong political headwinds.
Mm-hmm. I've heard a number about 2024, 2025, we're going to run into financial problems with Medicare.
Well, yeah, that's the current estimate. I suspect we're going to run into it much sooner because we're spending much more than we're actually bringing in. So that problem date is probably going to fall significantly over the next couple of years. So I suspect it's going to be much earlier.
And we're spending money that we need to, that perhaps we can cut without it affecting a lot of people?
Well, that's what the debate's all about. You hit the nail on the head. People are always coming up ways for saving money, but usually it affects somebody in a negative way, and that group fights back, whether it's providers who are going to ask to get perhaps not the same increases they expected or cuts, or patients who might feel that they're being denied a service. So that's where the big battle is going to be.
Mm-hmm. We've been hearing, and it most notably is coming from our Congressman Paul Ryan, about changes. He had fairly significant changes outlined, and they've changed somewhat. Can you tell me about this Medicare Advantage and what the plans would be on the part of some to expand Medicare Advantage and perhaps cut the number of people who are in traditional government-run fee-for-service programs?
Yeah, that's right. Well, we have currently within the Medicare program a option for people who are on Medicare. Rather than getting their coverage directly through government, they sign up for some private health insurance plan, either a for-profit or a not-for-profit, called a Medicare Advantage plan. And this plan, whether it's run by Blue Cross or United or one of the other insurance companies, provides the beneficiary with services, and the payments go from the government, from the Medicare program, directly to the insurance company. And people can get more benefits from some of these Medicare Advantage plans but they have to be willing to work within the constraints of the insurance. Now, Congressman Ryan has had two different proposals. The first one, which got him into a lot of difference of opinion and trouble, was he said over time what we would do would be eliminate the traditional Medicare program and require everyone who is on Medicare to receive their benefits through a private plan, and that the government would pay the private plan, but that it would limit the amount of money that it paid the private plan, with the likely possibility that more and more of the costs would be borne by the beneficiaries, which, needless to say, caused a big backlash.
Right.
The new proposal, which he is now proposing with Senator Wyden from Oregon, is that traditional Medicare would continue, but that the government payment for the traditional Medicare and the Medicare Advantage plans would be limited. He has not said exactly how these payments would be limited, and there is a lot of concern still that what it would do would be to put more financial responsibility on the beneficiary to get these plans.
Why would you, what's the reason for having the money go to the insurance companies?
Well, there are two. One is the feeling by Congressman Ryan and many others that these private companies, by competing against each other, would find ways to provide a different set of benefits. They would be more likely to try to make us healthier by giving us more information on how to take care of ourselves, that they would be more efficient in a way than the government. So that's the first reason. The second is that over time, Congressman Ryan and others believe that you cannot have the government continue to pay out almost a blank check, and that it needs to restrict somewhat how much it pays out in Medicare because the revenues are not there. And by doing this so-called premium support, you can essentially limit somewhat government payments in the future. So there are two sides, more efficiency and also a way for government to limit the growth and how much it spends.
Was this plan a part of the original idea for Medicare when it was founded? Do you have
No, not at all. Not at all. The original Medicare program was very straightforward. It was what we think of as traditional Medicare. You become automatically eligible for Part A, which gives you hospital care and some nursing home care, and you voluntarily sign up for Part B. The government collects revenues through your payroll taxes for A, and that the government and the beneficiary share in the cost of Part B, and that the benefits are provided by government. That was the plan for everybody until the mid-1980s, when these so-called Medicare Advantage plans were established. They used to be called Medicare Managed Care. They've changed their name, but essentially they're private options for people to take it rather than traditional Medicare.
So why did we start looking at alternatives to the traditional Medicare program? What was the reason?
Well, several, but the main one is the one I said before. There were many Americans signed up for the so-called managed care plans, the biggest one in California and Oregon and Washington, the Kaiser Permanente health system, and they wanted to stay in them, and they couldn't if they had to leave and get on traditional Medicare. So people were petitioning the government to allow them to stay there and to receive their Medicare benefits. And these programs began to grow all over the country, and you have several in Wisconsin. We have them here in Massachusetts. They're all over. And so many beneficiaries, Medicare beneficiaries, said, hey, we want to stay with these plans, and we want to get our care. So after the government looked at it through the late 70s, early 80s, it set up a plan to allow people to use their Medicare benefits through private insurance.
What Medicare services are the most expensive and deserve careful examination?
Well, clearly, when an individual goes into the hospital for major procedures, that's the most expensive single event. But in terms of long-term spending, it's individuals who are chronically ill, who constantly need medical care, whether they are suffering from some form of COPD, which is, you know, congestion in their lungs and their difficulty breathing, or some kind of disability. These, over time, cost the government the most.
COPD, there's something that we didn't even hear about 5 years ago, and now the number of television commercials is phenomenal.
I know. You can't watch the evening news or any of the other programs without seeing more commercials for more services, for more diseases we didn't know existed. You're absolutely right.
You were quoted in an article recently talking about the healthcare system coming up with more expensive procedures and techniques. Many, you said, improve health and save lives, but not all of the new techniques and procedures help patients. There is concern that doctors are requesting expensive imaging tests based on symptoms that don't call for such aggressive investigation.
Yes, it is. I'm a big believer in our healthcare system and in the improvements that it's making. I want to make that very clear. However, there is a lot of pressure on the system to adopt all the new things that come down the pike. Some of them are very helpful, but others have never been proven to really be that effective. Most people don't realize it, but in this country, when the FDA approves something, whether it's a device or a drug, all it says is that that drug or device is safe and has some positive impact on your health. What it doesn't say is whether the benefits come anywhere close to the cost of the procedure. And we, in this country, therefore, take on a lot of very expensive new procedures with very little evidence that they really are worth anywhere near their costs. Within the last couple of years, the federal government has been funding or beginning to fund the so-called comparative effectiveness research to sort of find out really what works better and where do you get the best bang for your buck.
Mm-hmm.
But that's in its infancy. So yes, we as a country need to be concerned. CT scans, for example, are extremely valuable, and in the hands of a clinician can be very helpful. On the other hand, there's a lot of evidence that we overuse them, and they're expensive. They can be upwards of $1,000 for one set of tests. And so there is much concern these days that we need to take a hard look on whether we as patients need all the tests and procedures that are being prescribed to us.
Do we also, Professor Altman, I've heard figures, and maybe you know them by heart, of the amount of money that we spend in the last couple months of life to keep people alive when it's inevitable that they're going to die, and we're just so hung up about death in this country that we can't face the inevitability?
Well, this is clearly one of the most controversial areas. The estimates are that Medicare spends about 25 or so percent of its total annual spending for individuals in the last years of life. And with Medicare approaching $500 billion, that's a lot of money. Now, of course, two things. First of all, we don't know what our last year of life is, which is our last year of life all the time. And second, there are a lot of reasons why we should be spending more money in the last years of life. So I don't want to be on record as saying that a lot of these interventions are not justified. On the other hand, there is growing evidence that a lot of money is really spent and wasted in those last efforts to keep people alive for another day or week or month. And while there's a lot of controversy about that, and there are religious reasons why you don't want to stop intervening, there are alternatives, one of which is hospice care, mm-hmm. which is a much more humane way of ending, you know, your life. So we need to talk about this, try to find the best solution for individuals, because not only is there a lot of money at stake, but many people find that it's a dehumanizing experience during those last days and months, and that we could do a better job. And so as a country, we need to talk about it. And you have in Wisconsin some really first-rate programs that are looking at this issue. We, for the rest of the country, can learn from your pathfinding work in Wisconsin.
We go to phone calls. Our lines are filled, and we'll start taking calls momentarily. The number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is Professor Stuart Altman. He is a professor of national health policy at Brandeis University and author of Power, Politics, and Universal Healthcare, The Inside Story of a Century-Long Battle. The number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our show this Thursday, Bob Berman will be joining us. He's a marvelous astronomer, has been with us several times before, and he has a book, The Sun's Heartbeat and Other Stories from the Life of the Star That Powers Our Planet. It is amazing how little we knew about the sun until, well, just about 150 years ago, and what people thought of the sun. The book is filled with fascinating information, and Bob's a great guest, so that's hour two of the show. Medicare this hour, let's go to phone calls, and we'll start with Dan in Three Lakes. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. I'm on Medicare, and I have one of these plans. I pay $31 a month. And, for example, I had open-heart surgery several years ago. My out-of-pocket cost was under $1,000, and they didn't mind at all that I took a year to pay it. But the three doctors, and I had a major, major open-heart surgery, three bypasses and other things. However, the three surgeons in the operating room, each put in a bill for just under $25,000. My understanding is that this Medicare Advantage plan doesn't do anything or pay anything that Medicare wouldn't pay. But the deal is my $31 enlists someone to handle the paperwork. And believe me, I get oodles of paperwork. Two of those three physicians had their bill disallowed completely, and the third one was knocked down to under $5,000. My out-of-pocket cost for that operation was under $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And they say the government can't run a program and save money? I mean, what's up with that? I just had a cataract out in Fort Dodge, Iowa. I went all the way to Iowa to the Wolf Clinic to get it done. The total cost between the doctor and the hospital was $7,500. My out-of-pocket was $35. And my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, and I hope you do, but providers that take Medicare have promised to write off the portion of the bill that's not covered by Medicare. But still, there are oodles of companies out there selling Medicare supplement plans on the basis that the unpaid portion will end up being your individual obligation. I've never had anybody come back with anything for me but my deductibles, and I'd like to know why. And I'll listen off the air.
All right. Thanks very much, Dan.
Well, let me, first of all, I'm much sympathetic, having just gone through open heart surgery myself.
Oh, you did?
Yes, I did.
How are you doing?
And I am also on Medicare, so I'm very sympathetic to Dan and what he talked about. Let me try. He raised a number of issues that are worth talking about. First, it is absolutely true that Medicare itself, not the the Medicare Advantage plans, Medicare itself has limits on how much it will pay for a service. And even a doctor can send in any bill he wants, but that the Medicare program sets established rates that it pays. And as he pointed out, in one case, the surgeon charged $25,000 and Medicare paid $5,000. That gap is much larger than most, but it could happen. Now, the Medicare Advantage plans use the same so-called fee schedules as Medicare. Now, what happens, first of all, let me make it very clear. The doctor cannot charge you more than what Medicare pays if they accept Medicare. They cannot do it. It is against the law. Now, there are some doctors, or a few, that do not accept what they call Medicare assignment, where they bill you directly, and then it's your responsibility to get the money from Medicare. But they're very few, but they do exist. And in that case, the gap, there is a small gap between what Medicare will allow them to charge you and then what Medicare will pay. But in no case will you be responsible for that full $25,000 if Medicare pays $5,000. And as Dan pointed out, Medicare does have limits, and some people, particularly physicians, believe that those limits are too tight, and that Medicare should be paying them more. But of course, if Medicare pays them more, then we have even a more serious cost problem than we have now. So it's a big debate now going on in the Congress.
Well, what's the truth here? I hear from some doctors that Medicare is paying them way too little.
Right.
Others say it's okay. What's the truth?
Well, I think it's fair to say that Medicare has developed a pretty tight payment system, particularly for physicians, and that the gap is growing between what Medicare pays and what doctors believe they should receive. And, you know, as much as I think Medicare justifies itself in, you know, being tight, I think it's fair to say that there are a number of physician specialties that are now being underpaid by Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to do something, particularly on the primary care side. The specialists do okay. It's the primary care physicians that are really being undercut by the Medicare payment system.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes it takes an event like open heart surgery, and you look at the bill and say, you're worth every penny.
Absolutely.
Right?
I buy that.
Right. Let's go to Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
Another excellent program. Thank you so much.
Sure.
My question is, it seems that I have been hearing forever that a major problem with Medicare is, I think they call it fee-for-service, where there is no disincentive for a doctor. In other words, you go in with a certain symptom, and they will run every test that they can think of because they're going to get paid for each of them. And there is that amazing correlation, I guess, between a hospital facility or a medical practice getting a new machine and the sudden need that everybody finds to run tests that use the new machine. So that being the case, if everybody seems to acknowledge that this is a major problem, that they ought to be paying them for treating the illness and not just running every test they can just because they can and it makes money for them, why isn't that ever considered as a real avenue to get a handle on this? And is it just the power of the AMA we're looking at, or what?
First of all, Scott, let me agree with you. This issue about fee for service has been around for a very long time. I've been in this healthcare business and worked for the federal government for much of my early life in the 1970s during both Republican and Democratic presidents. And we have been, as a country, trying to figure out a better way to pay for medical care, because you're absolutely right. Fee-for-service is a system which is fraught with incentives to just do more. Not only do more, but find the most expensive thing to do. We talked about that before. We have tried several different approaches as a country. In the 1990s, we went to what we call capitation or managed care. Now, there are problems with that. If the capitated rate or the total rate that a delivery system gets for all your care is too low, and then there may be incentives for the medical community to do too little. We are now trying a new approach, and it's built into the recent health reform legislation. They're called accountable care organizations, or another approach is called bundled payments, where, say, a delivery system says, I will provide, in this case, let's say, open heart surgery for a fixed amount of money, and if I need to do more tests or I need to keep the person in the hospital a longer time, then I won't charge any more. And if the delivery system can save, they will share the savings with the government. It's called the shared savings approach. But without getting any more detail, Scott, you're absolutely correct. Fee-for-service is a system that unfortunately just rewards doing and not necessarily doing the best thing.
Hmm. Can I ask another question?
Yes, you may.
Would this be something that they, since every GOP candidate for president is hell-bent on rolling back the Obamacare, as they call it, is this something that's in their crosshairs as well?
You know, that's a good question, and I, my cynical side says that, you know, they're so hell-bent on opposing anything that Obama has proposed they're probably against it. Maybe if they had power, you know, in principle, in the past, Republicans have been very much for these kinds of things. So I'm hoping that we can bring some bipartisan support for a new and improved way of paying for Medicare. But given the political environment today, I'm not very optimistic.
Great. Thanks again so much.
Thanks. Thanks, Scott, for the call. We go to Craig in Madison next. Hi, Craig.
Hi. I'm calling. I'm 23 years old, and we have a long future ahead of me of probably medical expenses for myself, but paying for other people's. And I guess I want to start having the discussion of why medicine costs so much in America. Well, around the world, medicine is so much cheaper. And I feel that we've been kind of subsidizing insurance companies as opposed to subsidizing more of the cost of medicine itself. And I guess that's my question.
Thank you, Craig.
Boy, you've asked a tough question. Forgive me, but it took my whole book to try to answer that question. So, I'll help you pay for it. But if you get the book, I can only sort of do not very much justice to your answer. Yes, medical care is far more expensive in the United States than it is in other countries. And the idea that we have private insurance does add a little to that reason, but it is not the main reason. Medical care in America is more expensive for lots of reasons. For example, we pay 50 to 100% more for the drugs we use than other countries because they have tight regulations on what they will pay. People in the medical field make more money in the United States. And I'm talking about everybody, not physicians alone, or even, although some physicians do make a lot of money. It's nurses, it's technicians, it's lawyers, it's everybody, because we have a very different payment system. We also use more expensive procedures. We talked about the idea. We use two or three times more CT scans per capita than other countries. We're much more likely to do complicated procedures than other countries. So it's there's a long list of the reasons why we're 50 to 100% more expensive and it's very difficult to change. Doctors will tell you one of the other reasons is malpractice. And there is a big fight going on in this country. If things don't go right, we're much more likely to sue the hospital or doctor. In other countries, A, you can't sue, because a lot of times you're suing the government, and they just throw the suit out, or they give limited amounts. So it's a long list, but you're correct. It is much more expensive in the U.S. than it is at every other country.
Thanks for the call, Craig. What about, this has been proposed, and I wonder if it's inevitable, that the eligibility age for Medicare is just going to have to go up, start it with a year, maybe a couple of years, as we live longer?
Well, that has been proposed, and it's already exists in Social Security. But let me remind you of an important fact that's easy to forget. If you save 1 year of Social Security, you save 1 year of Social Security. But in Medicare, if you move the age up, say, from 65 to 66 or 67 or 68, that's when most people are relatively healthy. So you don't save proportionally nearly as much as a percentage in Medicare as you do Social Security. Second, this is a very vulnerable age for people. Many people are just barely hanging on to their job or trying to supplement. They may have retired at 60 or been laid off at 55, and they're barely hanging on to 65. Mm. If you push that age up, you're going to lead to either a lot of people becoming uninsured at the worst time, or if the government subsidizes them, you're going to wind up pushing them into Medicaid or into subsidized insurance. So, yes, it is an option and probably will happen, but it is an option with a lot of downsides.
Mm-hmm. Why does this thing have to be so darn complicated? It's just incredible, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Oh. I tell people many times, I said, America does not do simple things.
No.
We find the most complicated way of doing practically anything.
Right.
And you're absolutely right. It has gotten very complicated. But it's the nature of our country that this is a very diverse country. And trying to find a solution that meets the needs of people in Wisconsin as opposed to New York, as opposed to Massachusetts, is very hard.
Mm-hmm. And only going to be harder if this excessive partisanship continues.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more.
Becca in Mineral Point. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Kathleen. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes.
Good. My phone's not getting great reception, but I'm just calling because this is a very interesting topic to me. I'm pretty young. My parents are baby boomers, but we're in the assisted living business. So thinking about long-term care and the impacts that providers have on the health of individuals in long-term care, one of the things we've been looking at is the Healthcare Innovation Challenge has some really interesting motives for reducing the cost of care and improving outcomes. And I was wondering if your guests could speak about some of the new things that are going on and what we can expect to see down the road in 10 or 20 years. You know, if things don't stay the same, what's going on to change it?
Well, Becca, first let me say that I'm very sympathetic to your line of business. My daughter, who lives in North Carolina, is also in the continuing care area, and it's a very important area. Now, but that brings us to a very hard fact, which many people tend to forget, and that is Medicare does not cover long-term care. It covers what we call post-acute care, which is for a limited period of time, say after you've gotten out of the hospital, like me who had open heart surgery. Many people go to a rehab place or a nursing home for a limited period. Medicare will pay for that. But it does not cover strict long-term care, people with Alzheimer's or some form of dementia. Second, Medicare does not pay for these continuing care communities, which are primarily a combination of housing and medical care. And even though there are many who believe that if we did cover long-term care, we could save money on the acute care side. It would be very expensive. A portion of it was in the health care reform law called the Class Act, but it was recently stripped because it was not well designed and really poorly funded. Unfortunately, we have a long way to go before we will cover long-term care adequately from the government. The only way you get it is if you're on Medicaid, which is only for poor people. So much as I'm sympathetic with what you're doing with respect to these continuing care, I think it's going to primarily continue to be a privately financed system.
And it's pretty easy to become a poor person if you're on long-term care, and you can become a poor person pretty quickly.
Yes, you can. And as a matter of fact, I know a little about the program in Wisconsin, and you have one of the highest, if I remember correctly, percentage of your Medicaid budget that goes for long-term care.
Hmm. Becca, did you have anything else?
Well, I actually didn't know that there had been some consideration of putting long-term care into Medicare, so that was actually very interesting.
And yes, you can look it up. It was called the Class Act, and it was developed by Senator Kennedy just before he died. But unfortunately, President Obama has just shut it down, and for good reason, because it was poorly designed and poorly financed.
It's another part. Thank you, Becca, for the call. It's another part of the healthcare system that I just don't get, because most of us have been through this long-term care experience with our parents, or we're thinking about it for ourselves, and it's such a mess in this country. We just haven't taken on this issue as we need to, I think.
Well, you're absolutely right. Most people have no idea. They think they have Medicare. They said, fine, well, I reach 65, I have Medicare. And if I have a need long-term care, it'll pay. And it's a rude shock
to
many people when they find that that Medicare doesn't pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
But let's understand, Medicare is already under serious cost constraints, and long-term care is very expensive. So if we are going to move in that direction, it would mean a need for a sizable increase in revenues, which unfortunately would need to come from taxes. And you know as well as I do that even the term taxes is considered a very dirty word.
No, really?
Hey, really?
Really?
Now, we in Massachusetts, we don't believe
right.
it. But, you know, you live in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Becca, for the call. Professor Stuart Altman is our guest. He's professor of national health policy at Brandeis University, and he serves as chair of the Health Industry Forum and the chair of the Council on the Economic Impact of Health System Change. He is an economist, and his research interests are in the area of federal and state health policy. He, in 2004, was awarded the Academy Health Distinguished Investigator Award. And he is with us this hour to talk about Medicare. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email, nobody's used that, but you can if you want, talk@WPR.org. And we should also tell you, we should interview him on this book sometime soon. He's the author of Power, Politics, and Universal Healthcare, The Inside Story of a Century-Long Battle. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, Bob Berman will join us. He's an astronomer, and he is the author of The Sun's Heartbeat and Other Stories from the Life of the Star That Powers Our Planet. It's a fascinating book, and he's a great guest. Back to phone calls on Medicare. Patricia in Madison. Hi.
Good morning. A very informative program, as always. I had seen a program on TV over the last number of years that at the time that Lyndon Johnson had signed Medicare into law, that he already knew that there was not going to be adequate funding for it and did not reveal the true figures, and of course, health care now is a lot more than it was back in the 60s. Can you verify that or say anything else about that?
Well, you may have either read or heard about a book that was written by a friend of mine, David Blumenthal, where he got hold of actual tapes of Lyndon Johnson's comments, as well as other presidents. And in that book, he does reveal the idea that when confronted by so-called experts at the time, that Medicare was going to cost a lot more than they had budgeted for, he said, oh, well, we'll deal with that later, and he dismissed it. And so you're absolutely correct. Now, you can't do that today because in 1974, the Congress passed a law that created a group called the Congressional Budget Office. And so every piece of legislation that is reviewed by the Congress or sent over by the president must be analyzed by a group of economists who are independent of any particular party, and they will come up with their own estimates about what the law will cost. Yes, you're correct. But even Lyndon Johnson or the experts at that time could not have realized really how expensive Medicare was to become.
Or the changes we would see, the advancement in technology, all these new machines, et cetera.
Exactly. And we completely redid our healthcare system in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Medicare, in a positive way, was a tremendous boon. It sort of modernized American hospitals, brought on a lot of new equipment, but it also, you know, was a way of really funding a lot of extra services and made a lot of people a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Patricia?
The only thing that it crossed my mind also, that I'm aghast when I read some of these, or I see on TV some of these stories about all the Medicare fraud that's being perpetuated on the government.
$500 billion brings out a lot of people whose motives we would not support. You're absolutely correct. And it is atrocious, but it turns out to be very difficult to find these people. They're very sophisticated crooks. They're not just little nickels and dimes. We actually have whole organizations who tend to figure out ways to sort of steal, if you will, money from the government in big amounts. And while every president, and this president in particular, has beefed up the amount of efforts being generated by the Justice Department, the FBI, it is a big, big number.
Thank you.
Thanks, Patricia. Marie in Bayview, hi.
Oh, my God, now I have so many things I have to say.
Okay. Well, say a couple at least.
Okay. Let's start with the fact that certainly not doctors, but most hospitals are nonprofit organizations. And the fact that, well, I know what my Medicare costs me. I have a supplementary insurance plan, and I get EOBs, which is explanation of benefits. That shows me exactly what has been paid and what, you know, I might have had to pay didn't have this supplementary insurance. And believe me, I've had to downgrade that insurance this year because I could no longer afford to pay the $100 a month for Part B plus almost $200 a month for supplementary insurance.
Yeah, it's a lot of money.
And I'll tell you something. It just galls me that we have these insurance companies. They're not working for nothing. These are not nonprofit organizations as hospitals are, and they're in it for a reason. So obviously they're skimming a lot of money off the top. But the other thing that galls me is was printed out. We get these, Milwaukee Magazine does us a service and shows us what people make. It'll list them, those things. We don't even have to go to our computer and figure it out. One of the smaller healthcare systems in our area is the Wheaton Frand system, and the president of that system made $3.75 million last year.
All right, you brought up a couple things. We're running out of time, so I want to make sure we get your response, Professor Altman.
Yes. Well, let me try to clear things up. It is true that there are for-profit insurance companies, but you could buy supplemental insurance from not-for-profit companies around the United States. Roughly half of the insurance companies are not-for-profit and half are for-profit. And their administrative costs run about 10% on average. The not-for-profits are 12%. Now, some of the for-profits run more. So, yes, I'm not defending them. And some of the amounts of money that the CEOs and others on make, you know, are significant. But they sound terrible, but the reality is that most of what we pay for, and I buy supplemental as well, goes for medical care. And it goes to the answer I gave a gentleman earlier on. Healthcare in America is very expensive. It is good quality care, although it's not as good as sometimes we like to think, but it's very expensive. And that's the reason why you're paying as much for supplemental. In the case of Medicare, your $100 is about 25% of the cost of the insurance. Three-quarters of it is being paid for by the government through your taxes.
Hmm. Thank you, Marie, for your call. Bill in Madison, hi.
Hi. Just two quick questions. I've heard that you're required to go on Medicare when you turn 65, that you have to drop your private insurance. And two, I wonder if your guest has an overall assessment of the economic effect that Medicare has had as a whole on the country's economy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let me clarify that. Medicare is broken up into four parts. Part A is the basic insurance for hospitals and for nursing homes and some home health. You automatically become eligible for that because you've already paid in, and therefore, in most situations, it makes no sense to continue your private insurance since you're going to get something that you've already paid for. Part B is for physician services and for for lab tests and so on. That's voluntary. But most people buy it because it's heavily subsidized by the government. It depends on the kind of private insurance you have. Some people hold on to their private insurance and don't take Part B, but you need to be careful. I'd have to know your situation. Then there's Part D for drugs, which is also voluntary, and you can use the government type, but those are all through private insurance. And then finally, there's that Part C, which is that Medicare Advantage that I talked about earlier. And there, what a lot of people do is they choose to stay with, say, their existing insurance, perhaps have a different plan, and get their Medicare benefits through that. So there are a lot of options out there, and I'd need to know your specific situation to let you know what's the right way.
Thanks, Bill. One more, Bill. We're almost out of time. From Madison, hi.
Okay, I was going to be a little more detailed, but I'll try to make it brief. To show people just how severe the problem is, I was stuck in the European Union a while back with an emergency situation. I had to be transported 100 kilometers to a hospital in Spain, and I received excellent care there. They apologized to me for not being able to get me in on their single payer plan, you know, because I'm an American. They built the entire bill for the night in the hospital, all the tests they ran, and the 100 kilometer ambulance ride was less than 100 euros out of pocket.
Wow.
And there is something really, and the quality I got was no different than what I would have received in America. And to me, there's something really rotten in Denmark.
All right, Professor Altman.
Well, I think I talked about it at length earlier on. There is no question healthcare in America is significantly more expensive. I'd need to look hard at that 100 euros, though. I don't know where, you know, that must have been heavily subsidized. I mean, the gap between the U.S. and Spain may be 50 to 100%, but 100 euros versus what could easily have cost you $20,000 in the United States or cost your insurance is a gap that I suspect was paid in part by the government over there.
Thanks for the call. Well, we have to have you on again talking about your book.
I'd love to.
Want to do
I'd
that?
To.
Okay.
So, but it's a pleasure. I mean, I'm I know Wisconsin. I've been to Madison and other parts many times. You have a great state.
Thank you, Professor Altman, and a very healthy New Year to you.
You too, as well. Thank you very much.
Professor Stuart Altman, Professor of National Health Policy at Brandeis University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this interesting hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios where the sun is streaming through the windows, and we're going to talk about the sun coming up.